Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, August 17, 2017. It's the two-year anniversary of the signed peace deal, but has it been implemented?
The agreement did not succeed in ending violence, restoring stability, reforming public institutions, and improving the living conditions of ordinary citizens across South Sudan. To the contrary, violence increased, ambushes have made roads impassable.
And what are the lessons learned from the 2015 peace deal?
There's a big competition among the IGAD countries. Everybody is vying for interest. And that cannot help them to solve problems of South Sudan. And we become the victim because our leaders easily like to, you know, go with the recommendations of these countries without asking why.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. It was 2 years ago that the agreement on the resolution of a conflict in South Sudan was signed by President Salva Kiir, rebel leader Riek Machar, and the former detainees and other political parties. The SPLA-IO faction led by first Vice President Taban Dengai acknowledges much more must be done to implement the deal. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Agel Machar, spokesman for the SPLM-IO Taban Dengai faction, says the surge in fighting in July last year between government soldiers and forces loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar hampered the implementation of the agreement, which includes six chapters on implementing the transitional government of national unity, setting up transitional security arrangements, and forming a hybrid court to hold those responsible for atrocities committed. Machar says despite the setbacks, the first vice president is working with the President Salva Kiir to implement the deal.
The government is in place, as you see. The assembly has been constituted. The issues of the speaker, the deputies was resolved. The National Constitutional Amendment Committee has finalized its work. Constitutional amendment is now with the Ministry of Justice.
Machar is referring to parts of chapters 1 and 2 of the deal. The rest of the peace agreement have not been implemented. The agreement requires that 7 months from its signing in August 2015, a National Elections Commission, or NEC, should be established to organize elections and set up a voters' registry, neither of which has happened. Chapter 2 of the agreement also requires the parties to the agreement to reorganize and unify their forces under one command to be named the National Defense Forces of South Sudan. Machar admits there have been many problems on the road to implementing the deal.
Ever since the president has declared unilateral declaration of ceasefire on this side, it has not been reciprocated on the other side. The issues of cantonment of forces has been very lagging because of lack of resources that were committed by or pledged by the donors. So the forces have not been cantoned properly where they're supposed to be cantoned because there is no funding. The issue of the humanitarian aspect, we are working very hard with the UN and the international agencies to make sure there are corridors for humanitarian work.
Machar blames rebel leader Riek Machar's SPLA-IO faction for delaying implementation of the agreement. He also blames regional and international powers for imposing some of the deal's provisions. Riek Machar, who signed the agreement, says it is dead and should be renegotiated. Last month, Festus Mohai, the head of the GMEC, the body tasked with the monitoring implementation of the agreement, described the deal as sick but worth revitalizing.
However, all parties must be committed to this objective. Second, revitalization of the agreement will be exactly that, the reinvigoration, re-energizing, and re-engagement of the 2015 peace agreement.
A report released this week by the activist group Voluntary Civil Society Task Force says 75% of the transitional period has elapsed without any significant achievement in implementing the peace deal. With just a few months to go before the transitional period expires, Task Force member Rajab Muhandis says the peace deal's objectives have not been met and the fighting has increased.
The agreement did not succeed in ending violence, restoring stability, reforming public institutions, and improving the living conditions of ordinary citizens across South Sudan. To the contrary, violence increased, ambushes have made roads impassable, at least one-third of the population in the country is displaced either internally or in the neighboring countries, and about 6 million South Sudanese citizens are severely food insecure.
Chapters 4 and 5 require the parties to enact measures to ensure transparency and accountability in utilizing the country's national resources and to hold those who committed crimes during the conflict accountable. Neither of those things have happened. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Civil society activists say since the agreement was signed, violence has only increased, and they accuse some neighboring countries of helping to fuel the war out of national interests. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Juba.
Bongiri Peter Lado, executive director for local rights group Humanity South Sudan, says even though the peace deal specifies a specific time frame for each provision, very little has been achieved so far. Lado says only Chapter 1, which details the formation of the Transitional Government of National Unity, has been implemented. He says fighting still rages in many parts of the country.
If you ask the parties to the agreement, do you have your containment sites? No. Is there a ceasefire of ZAP? No. Transitional security arrangements, do you have security? No. The citizens are suffering, the roads are under attacks.
Lado also accuses countries such as Uganda, Sudan and Kenya of, quote, playing a negative game to reap the benefits from South Sudan's continuing conflict. Peter says the lesson South Sudanese warring parties should learn from nearly 4 years of fighting, which has plunged country into humanitarian and economic chaos, is to work together as brothers and sisters and resolve their differences peacefully. He says regional countries have not helped.
There's a big competition among the IGAD countries. Everybody is vying for interest. And that cannot help them to solve problems of South Sudan. And we become the victims because our leaders easily like to, you know, go with the recommendations of these countries without asking why.
Agnes Wasuk-Sorofino, National Coordinator for Women's Issue at the South Sudan Council of Churches, says women have borne the brunt of the conflict, including rape, displacement and hunger.
Now the country is experiencing economic crisis, which now everybody can see in South Sudan. People are really suffering. There's no stability, there's no good food that people can eat. You know, people are now crying badly for peace.
Ongwaro Joseph works for the local NGO Advocacy for Human Rights and Democracy. He says guarantors of the peace deal have not done their job to ensure that the agreement is fully implemented.
We expected IGAD, the UN, and then the TRICA to be more strict to oversee the implementation of peace agreement. But to our dismay, we also say a backtracking from the international community.
Ongwaro also says peace will only come to South Sudan if its citizens identify their problems and agree to resolve them peacefully and live as unified people. Stephen Robo Musa, who works in WAO with the local NGO Community Empowerment for Progress Organization, or CEPO, says the latest IGAD plan to revitalize the 2015 peace agreement may be the last chance for the peace in the country.
I hope that the revitalization of the peace agreement should really have more community engagement rather than have more political engagement, where if they differ among themselves, like just the try to mobilize their group or their ethnic line to join a conflict where they are not part of.
Civil society activists say they hope that by now South Sudan leaders realize the country is yearning for peace and their differences must be resolved through dialogue. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Many South Sudanese say they have little trust in the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or JMAC, the body tasked with monitoring the implementation of the August 2015 peace agreement. Some residents of Juba say JMAC must do more to ensure the agreement is implemented, and it should produce reports that reflect what is happening in South Sudan. We asked some Juba residents whether they trust JMAC to continue monitoring the agreement, and here is what they have to say.
I do trust them, but not all that, because if you look at the current situation now, compared to the peace agreement, it's so far 2 years, but there's no change. We are just like in one place. We're just like stagnant, you know?
Many people have lost confidence in JMAC, and particularly myself. I'm a bit disappointed. We had a bigger hope in JMAC, and we thought, well, JMAC is everything. And we found out they have done little and have literally done something which does not satisfy the South Sudanese people. I wish if there's another way to make JMAC work, we were waiting to see.
In my opinion, JMAC should not continue because since they were brought on board, you have seen things have not gone on well. You see, fighting is still going on in some parts of South Sudan. And yeah, that's my opinion. I think they have not done their best.
Though people say the peace agreement is not really fully implemented, but I think JMAC at this stage, they really have a role to play so that they are able to bridge the gap of the warring party in South Sudan so that they continue implementing the peace agreement.
JMAC should not continue because there's nothing changed now in the country. Things have been going worse every month. There's no change. So what's the reason of them continue monitor the Southern Sudanese? I don't trust them to continue. It's better to start a new change now.
I really trust them because this is where the source of conflict was, and they have to continue looking on monitoring the peace agreement. Yeah, if it is being implemented, so we could not have a serious conflict as it's going on around the country. I mean,
so I completely don't put all my trust in them. Though they're also playing their role, but if they could add in some effort, yeah, things will work out.
What JMAC has not done clearly is that people are in blue. They don't know what is going on. If you tell us the parties are not implementing the peace agreement, and you have not explained procedures of the peace agreement. For instance, we have been waiting issue of the ceasefire. I mean the issue of action on the violation of ceasefire. JMAC cannot say who is doing what. The parties keep on accusing themselves. But as a monitoring and verification body, what have you done to come out to say, to verify the issues?
I don't trust JMAC because after these 2 years, nothing has been improved. There's a lot of death, a lot of crisis. Things are going worse. So we don't expect them to continue with their job as they are there guiding the peace agreement that has been signed.
I think JMAC, in the implementation of the peace agreement, JMAC is important and paramount to South Sudan because they have a huge task that they need to accomplish, despite the fact that they have a lot of gaps in their work and all that. But to me, I think they still need to deliver, and they need to continue monitoring the implementation of the peace agreement.
These are voices of residents of Juba commenting on the work of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, a body tasked with implementing the 2015 August peace deal. Uganda is a home to 1 million South Sudanese refugees. Aid agencies say the milestone number reached this week is a call to action for the international community, not only to donates money, but also renew efforts to end the conflict in South Sudan. Halima Athumani has the story from Kampala, with reporting in northern Uganda by Jason Patenkin.
Exhausted families continue to arrive in Uganda this week as the total number of South Sudanese refugees in the country hit the 1 million mark. Armed rebels kept a close watch on the South Sudanese side of the border as the people cross. The new arrivals braved heavy rains, cold nights, and the scorching sun to find safety. Once on the Ugandan side, Lesi Iya and her family stopped to rest. She says they stayed for 3 weeks under trees with only saucepans, plates and some cups for water. She says they need to be taken to a place to find peace and leave what happened behind. South Sudan's civil war began in December 2013, but aid agencies say there has been increasing violence. A power-sharing deal fell apart in July of last year. Civilians have borne the brunt of the conflict. According to the International Committee of the Red Cross, one in three of South Sudan's 12 million residents has been displaced, while one in two is severely hungry and in need of food assistance. Amnesty International has called the 1 million mark a wake-up call for the international community, which it says must take measures to stop violence and other abuses against civilians in South Sudan. The United Nations says since July 2016, Uganda has been receiving on average 1,800 South Sudanese refugees a day, 85% women and children. UNHCR Uganda spokesperson Charlie Yangsley says a 14-year-old girl named Tabu Sunday is a symbolic 1 millionth South Sudanese refugee to arrive.
She was forced to flee after armed groups attacked her village in the middle of the night. Together with her aunt, she spent weeks traveling through the bush, being forced to eat nothing but water lilies and drinking water from dirty streams in order to arrive safely in Uganda.
Three quarters of the South Sudanese refugees in Uganda have arrived in the past year, overwhelming the country's resources, says the International Rescue Committee, IRRC. IRRC Country Director in Uganda, Angela Rugambwa, says it is the world's fastest growing refugee crisis.
There is not a slowdown in terms of refugees crossing over to Uganda. It's only been on the increase. And there hasn't been any corresponding means in terms of international aid that is coming in to cater for the 1 million South Sudanese refugees.
Yangsley says of the $674 million needed for this year, UNHCR has received only 21%.
Many refugees have seen their food rations cut in half. We see health clinics with insufficient doctors, drugs and healthcare workers. Let's be clear, this is a real children's crisis. It's children that are being forced to flee through the bush, often in the middle of the night, for days, if not weeks on end. So there's a desperate need for a surge of solidarity with Uganda in order to ensure that these refugees are able to live in safety and in dignity.
Yangsley says a resolution to the conflict in South Sudan appears nowhere in sight.
So it's key that the international community comes forward to use the political influence they have over the leadership in South Sudan to bring the warring factions together to the table in dialogue so that we can bring an end to the bloodshed.
For now, all the 1 million South Sudanese refugees in Uganda can do is wait. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up next, we look at the number of people displaced in all over the world. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
was there a time when you didn't have enough to eat? How did you cope?
Yes, there was a time, many times, when I didn't have what to eat. Normally, I do run to friends or sometimes relatives to help me out.
I slept, and when I woke up, took a lot of water. I slept for a very long time, like 6 hours in the day. So I didn't feel the hunger. So when I woke up, I drank a lot of water again.
Several times, yeah, because given our situation, the moment that you really barely have anything to eat. But again, the word of God is clear. Man does not live on bread alone. In some situations, one has to adapt. You have to understand that.
The university, my money got furnished. So what did I do? I went to a friend's room and pretended I was going to visit. There was food and I took some.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan is among the countries that has seen the highest number of internal displaced people due to conflict. The head of the Geneva-based Internal Displacement and Monitoring Center, Bina Desai, tells INBR that with the ongoing conflict in the Middle East and sub-Saharan Africa, displacement figures will increase dramatically over the rest of the year.
And in particular, if we look at the numbers of displacement by conflict, it's very concerning because we have reached already two-thirds by mid-year of the total number of displacements by conflict of all of 2016, of last year. So, and we can expect with the current crisis that we do see, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa and the Middle East, that these numbers will increase exponentially over the rest of the year.
What is the leading cause of displacement?
In terms of just the total numbers, every year over the last years, we've seen that the higher figures are in fact related to disaster displacement. However, that we have to take a little bit with a grain of salt, because of course in the context of disasters, particularly in the context of sudden onset disasters like major cyclones, earthquakes or floods, so in terms of the numbers, disaster displacement figures are usually higher. But then in terms of not just duration of displacement, but severity, we do find a large number of the conflict situations that are much more severe. And you know, some of it is intuitive, but like, you know, full-out war in the Middle East or active conflict in, say, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. But there's also regions where conflict and violence are more simmering, communal tensions actually do displace people, create heightened levels of insecurity that also displace a large number of people that wouldn't necessarily be, you know, be so intuitive and so clear, because it's really more a confluence of drivers that then makes people move and pushes them really to move. That, and for example, one context is the Horn of Africa, that where we've seen, you know, food insecurity actually being triggered by both a drought but also ongoing conflict and violence.
And speaking of the Horn of Africa, the total number of displaced people in Ethiopia is 588,000, and we're now learning that refugees in Uganda are close to crossing the 1 million mark. What do these figures tell us?
What they tell us in particular is that the overall risk of new displacement and of actually also repeated displacement and cyclical movements is not being reduced. So whereas, you know, in all these countries, all humanitarian actors as well as regional entities are trying to address the protection needs and assistance needs of those affected, what is really not invested in enough is obviously conflict prevention, but also more long-term investment into development, economic and social environmental development in the region that is significant enough to actually allow the structures to develop to reduce this displacement risk. I mean, we have seen in South Sudan in particular, as you've mentioned it, has been topping has been part of the top 10 of countries with the highest numbers of new displacement since 2003 every year. So there's clearly something going very wrong. I also mentioned repeated displacements and the cyclical movement. That is a huge problem in the whole region. South Sudan's refugee population is in 2016 was the largest in all of Africa. And now there are about, I think, more than 1.5 million people are now estimated to be living in the neighboring countries. So Ethiopia, Kenya, Sudan, and Uganda. And that's really, that's of course a critical issue for the whole region and a very destabilizing issue.
Have you seen anything like this before?
Yes, sadly we have. It is not, and it remains to be seen what happens, as I said, over the rest of the year. But it's what is really sad is not necessarily, I think, that numbers or it's not, if numbers are not ever increasing, that doesn't tell us that we're actually tackling the problem. And on the contrary, numbers are actually almost stagnant over time. We've seen increases, we've seen slight reductions, but in general, the problem is not going away. On the contrary, it is very much there to stay. And we do see, as I started off saying, we do see that the underlying drivers of the problem and of the phenomenon and of the experience of these people are not being addressed, which is really not just being exposed to conflict or disasters and hazards, but to actually be very vulnerable to them, because there's not enough investment being made into kind of the basic economics and social development in those regions concerned.
That's Bernard Desai, head of the Geneva-based International Displacement and Monitoring Center. She spoke to Ayen Bior from Geneva on Wednesday. Zimbabwean First Lady has requested diplomatic immunity for an incident where she allegedly assaulted a young woman in Johannesburg. The incident has sparked public outrage in South Africa and could also complicate relations between the neighboring countries. VOA's Anita Powell looks at the situation from Johannesburg with reporting from Sebastian Mahafu in Harare.
The accusations that Zimbabwe's First Lady Grace Mugabe assaulted and badly hurt a young woman in an upscale Johannesburg hotel this week have grabbed international headlines. The incident has also created a major diplomatic headache for two neighbors who have delicate relations. Zimbabwe and South Africa are major trade partners, but in recent years, instability and economic woes have sent millions of Zimbabweans fleeing across the border. They form a loud and angry diaspora that almost unanimously calls for South Africa to condemn President Robert Mugabe, who has ruled Zimbabwe since 1980. This event has thrown these issues into sharper focus. Here is South African International Relations spokesman Clayson Monyela when asked what the government plans to do.
We've been advised not to comment on this thing any further.
His department has the job of deciding whether to grant Grace Mugabe's request for diplomatic immunity, which would spare her from prosecution. The First Lady failed to appear before police Tuesday to give a statement. On Thursday, South African prosecutor Harry Nell, who has been nicknamed the Bulldog, said his organization, Afroforum, would provide legal representation for the alleged victim, 20-year-old Gabriella Engels. He says Mugabe's request for immunity should not be granted, on the grounds that initially she said she was visiting South Africa for medical treatment, and not, as she now says, to attend a regional summit alongside her husband.
It's not automatic. There's lots of prescriptions and things that should be followed before somebody can claim immunity.
Could Grace Mugabe be put on trial? Zimbabwe scholar David Moore of the University of Johannesburg says South Africa's government is in a very sticky position, in part because Mrs. Mugabe has positioned herself to be her aging, ailing husband's successor.
Now, if Grace Mugabe is disgraced through this event in South Africa, you'd have a very unpopular leader of a party, and a very temporary leader because she's volatile, as we can see. So that would lead to more uncertainty on the borders of South Africa. So South Africa now has to worry about how they handle this situation with Grace Mugabe, how that will affect politics in Zimbabwe.
South African officials say Grace Mugabe is still in the country, but have not given her location. Her husband Robert arrived in the country late Wednesday to attend the summit of the Southern African Development Community. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
That report by Anita Powell from Johannesburg brings us to the end of our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song "And Then a Bullet Jadid" by Ras Corby. We have been listening to Ras Corby with the song "And Then a Bullet Jadid." I am John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could be here. Drop us a line on what you think about the show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on our Facebook page, South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.